This is Free Speech Radio News for May 11th. I'm Matt Martin. Coming up...
In the name of development, its projects and programs have destroyed the livelihoods of people, brought about the disintegration of local and indigenous communities, violated ancestral domains, undermined sovereign self-determination.
Cops wearing leis face off with protesters as the Asian Development Bank meets in Honolulu. A federal judge in Idaho blocks a ban on road building in national forests, and South Dakotans consider an initiative to legalize industrial hemp. In a precedent-setting anti-globalization protest, 1,000 peaceful marchers drummed, danced, and shouted in jubilee against the meeting of the Asian Development Bank, or ADB, held this week in Honolulu. Critics claim the ADB's policies contribute to deforestation, indigenous displacement, the erosion of workers and human rights, water and air pollution, starvation, poverty, economic dependency, and civil strife. The ADB, founded in 1966 and based in Manila, has 59 member countries, but the two most powerful members, the U.S. and Japan, dominate its direction and policies. Chris Cottrell files this report from Honolulu.
Demonstrators carry their message to the start of the Asian Development Bank's 34th Annual Governors Board meeting amidst a militarized atmosphere created by the city of Honolulu, the state of Hawaii, and federal security agencies. Police, many of whom wore aloha shirts and leis to appear non-threatening, outnumbered the marchers by as many as 3-1. Security costs reach as high as $7 million in a state that's just now pulling itself out of a 10-year recession. After a brief gathering at a nearby park, protesters proceeded 1 mile to the conference at the Hawaii Convention Center, a mammoth white building with an enormous glass facade. With police helicopters humming overhead, Hawaiian sovereignty activists blew conch shells and bamboo pipes and chanted a special prayer ceremony in the Hawaiian language to begin the main rally. Dr. Walden Bello, professor of economics at the University of Manila and director of Focus on the Global South based in Bangkok, then took to the microphone and announced that the president of the ADB, Tadeo Aquino, who has never before met with demonstrators, was coming out of the convention center to listen to protesters' demands. With community activist Samboth Somphone of Laos and Darwan Chantarabas of Thailand at his side, and a crowd of around 1,000 shouting indigenous, international, youth, labor, environmental, and interfaith protesters at his back, Bello read a petition directly to President Aquino.
In the name of development, its projects and programs have destroyed the livelihoods of people, brought about the disintegration of local and indigenous communities, violated ancestral domains, undermined sovereign self-determination, promoted the sharp rise in inequality, deepened poverty, and destabilized the environment. Representatives of peoples, indigenous communities, and organizations throughout the region have had enough of this destruction in the name of development. We have had enough of an arrogant institution that is one of the most non-transparent, undemocratic, and unaccountable organizations in existence.
From the conference, the crowd paraded through tourist-choked Waikiki to another venue at Kapi'olani Park. A phalanx of bicycle police surrounded the crowd for the entire march, blocked key intersections, and stood in front of stores, while bewildered and curious tourists watched or took photographs for the vacation album. Dr. Haunani K. Trask, a renowned Hawaiian sovereignty activist and professor of Hawaiian studies at the University of Hawaii at Manoa, assessed the police power.
If you pay $750,000 for stun guns, for more police, you yourselves are symbols of violence. You yourselves, since police have a monopoly of violence, you yourselves are armed. You yourselves have cars, helicopters, and guns, and clubs. And you're telling us, who are peacefully protesting, using, in essence, our civil right, our human right to make our voices heard, you're telling us that we are criminals?
Meanwhile, inside the heavily guarded convention center, the ADB kicked off a program to reduce poverty in Asia over the next 15 years, a plan that critics in the street say will actually increase poverty, pollute air, contaminate water, destroy forests, and undermine indigenous labor and human rights. The protest's organizer, ADB Watch, a broad coalition of concerned groups, feel they've conveyed their anti-globalization message effectively, despite the high hurdles placed in front of them by the city. For example, march permits had been delayed or denied since last January, and it took a lawsuit filed by Brent White, legal director of the Hawaii State ACLU, before the city relented. The city also passed ordinances that give police wide leverage to arrest people camping in parks, wearing costumes, carrying glass, or possessing containers that emit noxious odors during the meetings. With the legal and police infrastructure created for the ADB, Honolulu will now market itself as the Geneva of the Pacific, and invite other financial institutions like the IMF, World Bank, or WTO to come here for conferences. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Christopher Cottrell in Honolulu.
More rolling blackouts in California this week, forcing the state's governor, Gray Davis, to once again place highest priority on the state's energy crisis. Davis held closed negotiations with the CEOs of energy generators and tried to strike a deal to continue selling power to the state's two major utilities. At the same time, California lawmakers also passed the biggest bond issue in U.S. history so the state can keep buying power. Katja Messer has more from Sacramento.
As California faced a third straight day of rolling blackouts, Governor Gray Davis met behind closed doors with the CEOs of major energy suppliers. Davis is trying to hammer out a deal with generators like Mirant, Duke, Dynegy, and Reliant to continue selling power to the state's two big utilities. Duke Energy indicated to the governor that they would be willing to strike a deal if he dropped investigations into allegations of price manipulation in the wholesale market.
We have a lot of differences. We think we've been overcharged dramatically. We're going to pursue every legal remedy available to us. We're not dropping any lawsuits. We're not dropping any legal any investigations. Quite the contrary, we're pursuing all those to the hilt. However, we have a collective interest in seeing that this summer has as few disruptions as possible.
The governor is demanding that energy suppliers reduce the amount of money California's utilities owe them by 30%. Meanwhile, Californian lawmakers moved to issue more than $13 billion in bonds to buy power. It's the biggest bond issue in U.S. history. Consumers will repay the bond with rate increases that will remain in place for the next 15 years. Consumer advocates like Medea Benjamin say rates will keep going up because the politicians are not taking action against the big energy companies.
Well, I think there's no end to this. Those bonds will be used up in no time, and then we'll be back again issuing other bonds. The only way to stop the bleeding of our money is to do something about the price of wholesale energy. We either got to have windfall profits tax, we got to have price caps, or we got to take them over.
The California legislature is considering such a tax, which would hit power companies who make more than 100% profit, with a levy so big the companies would lose money if they didn't keep their profits in line. Proponents of the measure say the tax would bring prices down. California's energy demand only increased 4% between 1999 and 2000. During the same time period, energy prices increased nearly 300%, resulting in a 500% profit for some energy generators. But Richard Wheatley, the director of the corporate communications for Reliant Energy of Houston, Texas, denies allegations of price gouging. He says competitive bidding by the utilities drove up market prices for power. Wheatley says the windfall profits tax measure creates a hostile environment for electricity generators in California.
What we have today is a very negative business environment that will only serve to discourage the attraction of capital investment into the state, not just by our company, but by business in general. What we're trying to establish today is a framework for a more collaborative process between the legislative and executive branches and private industry, so we can foster a more positive climate. That, in turn, will help the citizens of California and solidify or stabilize your marketplace.
While Davis met with the CEOs of the major generators, California's Public Utilities Commission announced another rate increase for consumers. PUC President Loretta Lynch said that increase targets consumers with a 40% rate hike if they do not conserve. That may not be the last rate increase, though. Electric rates may go up again if the price of energy continues to rise. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Katja Mester in Sacramento.
A federal judge in Idaho blocked a ban on road building in a quarter of national forest land on Thursday, saying the Clinton administration rule needed to be amended or it would cause, quote, irreparable harm. The decision by U.S. District Judge Edward Lodge came less than a week after the Bush administration said it would allow the rule to take effect this Saturday. It's now up to the administration to decide whether to fight the injunction, even though the U.S. Department of Agriculture had announced it would revise the rules to allow for more local input, a move expected to seriously weaken the road building ban. Lee Robartis has more on the controversy from Idaho.
After taking stinging criticism for its plans to drill in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge and to scrap the Kyoto Global Warming Treaty, the Bush administration announced it plans to go ahead with the preservation of 58 million acres of Forest Service land. The plan was put in place by Clinton during his final days in office. But the Bush Department of Agriculture, which oversees the Forest Service, says it will modify the rule in June on a forest-by-forest basis to take into account local communities' concerns over resources and access. Despite this, Idaho plans to push forward with its lawsuit, attempting to throw the rule out, claiming public comment rules weren't followed, that the Forest Service failed to consider alternatives that would protect lands but still allow roads, and that access to some state land would be hindered if surrounded by federal roadless areas. Alaska and Utah are also suing. Idaho Deputy Attorney General Thorpe Orton, the lead attorney in the case, says the rule was illegally fast-tracked. And he says even though 95% of public comments supported the roadless policy, that doesn't tell the whole story.
Environmental groups will accurately say that 1.1 million people commented during the draft EIS period, and that is a large number of people. However, if you look at the facts, it becomes a little more murky. You find out that 800,000 comments, which were nothing more than postcards, pre-printed postcards, were delivered on the final day of the comment period by an environmental consortium. And the most detailed comments, which came from governmental entities, I think about 30,000 of those, 62% were against the roadless proposal.
Last month, federal judge Edward Lodge ruled there was enough merit for the suit to go forward. In his ruling, Lodge said it was likely public comment procedures were not followed. Although the rule impacts roadless areas of 5,000 acres or more in forests from Maine to California, most roadless acres are in Rocky Mountain states like Idaho, where the rule applies to 17% of the state's land base. Also, environmentalists say the Forest Service can't maintain the roads it has. They say the agency has an $8 billion backlog in road repairs on its 500,000 miles of existing roads. Chuck Pajeski of the Idaho-based environmental group Friends of the Clearwater says the state is run by corrupt elites.
Basically, we have a lawsuit that may receive a favorable ruling because it comes in front of a pro-timber judge, and the elites are mad because they didn't get their way this time. The people got their way, and so now they want to have it thrown out.
Pajeski says of the 58 million acres covered by the roadless rule nationwide, only about 9 million acres have marketable timber, and the rest are mountain meadows, rock and glaciers, or just too steep. A study by the University of Idaho commissioned by the Forest Service estimated a loss of about 1,300 jobs in 28 rural towns in southwestern Idaho due to the roadless rule. But Pajeski believes even if the numbers are correct, that's a drop in the bucket for the state's growing economy.
The timber industry is a collapsing industry in Idaho. There are hardly any places left in Idaho that you could classify as timber-dependent communities. There's only a couple of small areas, and those places are seeing rapid withdrawal, not because of the roadless policy, but, you know, they're under pressure from Canadian imports, they're under pressure from a collapsing lumber market, they're under pressure from low housing starts. The timber industry has been a very, very, very poor steward of not only our public lands, but also our local communities.
It's high quality natural environments that are drawing people and businesses to the Mountain West.
Tom Power is a University of Montana economist who has made a career of studying the impacts of resource extraction in the West.
The growth that's been taking place in Idaho as well as throughout the Rocky Mountain West has been tied to the high-quality living environments that those protected public lands provide. So that if one contrasts communities that haven't relied upon high levels of timber harvest from public lands with those that have, one finds far more economic vitality and prosperity in those towns that have diversified and are relying on those public lands now to support a broad variety of environmental services, quality of life, rather than supplying commercial timber for a few mills.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Lee Robartis in Moscow, Idaho.
This week, the president of the American College of OBGYNs called for the so-called morning after pill to be made available to women without a prescription. For decades, emergency contraception was made available to women by their physicians. But many women were unaware of the option because no major pharmaceutical company wanted to produce and market emergency contraceptives. In September of 1998, the first commercially produced emergency contraception was approved by the Food and Drug Administration. Since then, access to emergency contraception has become a public policy issue for local and state health officials across the country. Earlier this spring, in California's San Bernardino County, the County Board of Supervisors voted 4-1 to halt the use of the contraceptive morning after pill in county health clinics. A state agency has suggested it will reject the supervisor's request. But county supervisors say they plan to take their case to the Bush administration, where they hope it will spark a change in national family planning policy. Robin Yurovich reports from San Bernardino.
San Bernardino County Supervisor Bill Postmas says he's leading the fight to ban the morning after pill at county clinics because he doesn't think teenagers should be able to obtain emergency contraception without their parents' permission.
If you want to provide a student with let's say a 12-year-old girl with an aspirin, that 12-year-old girl must have parental permission. If you want to give a girl a morning after pill in a county clinic, you don't have to obtain permission from that parent. And it's an issue of parental consent, number one. Number two, it's an issue of local control, local standards.
Inside family planning clinics like this one in the city of San Bernardino, public health workers say adult women use emergency contraception at far greater rates than teenagers. Out of 640 patients who took the morning after pill last year, just 32 of them were under 16. Clinic worker Rita Contreras says those teenagers come because they don't have other options.
Somehow the kids don't feel they can communicate with their parents. That's what's happening. That's the bottom line.
According to federal rules, San Bernardino has to provide evidence to prove that the morning after pill damages women's health. Officials at the California Family Health Planning Council say it hasn't done that. If they don't get additional documentation, they'll deny the supervisor's request. Supervisor Bill Postmas, reached at his Victor Valley field office, says he expected the rebuff.
It was obvious to me that they were trying to stonewall this issue, and we just basically want to move on.
Moving on, says Bill Postmas, means an appeal to the Bush administration, where he believes they'll get a sympathetic hearing.
Now we have a new Secretary of Health and Human Services, Tommy Thompson, and we believe that Tommy Thompson also believes in local control. And I felt that at this point it was important to allow the administration to change the policy of the government with regards to this.
Family planning advocate John Dunn, who heads Planned Parenthood of Orange and San Bernardino counties, says he's worried that this case gives the Bush administration a chance to restrict family planning services for poor women around the country who depend on federally funded health care.
Given the recent history of the Bush administration with regard to international family planning, I would be extremely concerned that President Bush will take this opportunity to make his first moves towards limiting family planning on the domestic side.
Dunn says other counties around the country that want to limit services may be watching for precedent that could be set in San Bernardino. Ironically, if the supervisors win their request to halt use of the morning after pill, its greatest impact might be felt outside of California, in states where family planning funds at the state level are unavailable. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Robin Yurovich in San Bernardino.
During last year's elections, seven states had measures on the ballot that dealt with reforming drug and marijuana laws. In Colorado, voters legalized the use of marijuana for medical purposes, while voters in Alaska chose not to pass a measure that would have legalized all forms and uses of marijuana. This year, organizers in South Dakota are already kicking off their petition drive to put the questions of medical marijuana and industrial hemp to a vote of the people next fall. If the measure is passed, South Dakota would be the first state to legalize industrial hemp by means of a citizens' initiative. From Custer, South Dakota, Joshua Welsh has this report.
So has everyone here registered to vote?
It's a warm, breezy day at the Custer County Courthouse, where about a dozen people have gathered to show support for Bob Newland, the spokesman for the South Dakota Cannabis Coalition. For years, Newland has tried to get state laws passed legalizing the cultivation of industrial hemp. Newland says hemp is a cash crop in 33 nations, including Canada, and South Dakota's struggling farmers are missing out on a lucrative opportunity.
Canadian hemp's being trucked past barely surviving South Dakota farms. There's no word for that besides absurd, unless it's maybe insane. Politicians have grand mal fits of absurdity when you bring up the word cannabis or hemp. And since we can't deal with them, since they only want to talk gibberish, we'll go directly to the people.
Some farmers in the state agree and have also lobbied the legislature to open the door to those who want to grow hemp. But lawmakers and law enforcers say legalizing hemp at the state level would do nothing to change the federal laws, under which all types of cannabis would still be illegal. But Newland says changing the state law by means of a citizen's initiative would send a message to state and federal lawmakers.
We realize that you're not going to be able to start farming hemp the day after South Dakotans vote 75% to remove the state barriers. But it'll be a strong statement on top of Minnesota's statement, North Dakota's statement, Montana's statement a couple of weeks ago. All those legislatures have overwhelmingly endorsed industrial hemp for their states. Our legislature won't even let it onto the floor.
In theory, changing state law would make it possible to grow hemp in South Dakota, but farmers wanting to do so would need to go through a lengthy permitting process. Alan St. Pierre is the executive director of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. He says the process is so difficult, not one farmer has ever been granted a permit.
The difficulty here, though, is just sending the farmers off on their own to then apply to the massive DEA bureaucracy here in Washington to get a variance from the very, very strict laws that prohibit not only the growing of hemp, but of course the growing of its sister, marijuana.
Changing state laws might also make it easier to grow hemp on Indian reservations in South Dakota. The Oglala Sioux tribe has made hemp legal, but the Lakota farmer who tried to grow it had his crop seized by DEA agents last summer. But St. Pierre says such tribal and statewide efforts in South Dakota and in other states across the Midwest will show the federal government that the industrial hemp movement is not just a cover for legalizing all marijuana.
It is not the drug law reform movement per se that has had the success of moving these bills along. It has been Raritan clubs, it has been Grange clubs, it has been the American Farm Bureau at its state level have moved this along. Future Farmers of America have moved this issue along at the most pragmatic level.
And it's that kind of support that Bob Newland is counting on. To put the matter on the ballot, he'll need around 16,000 signatures. If he does that, the whole state will vote on industrial hemp in November. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Joshua Welsh in Custer, South Dakota.
The Civil Service and Labor Committee of the New York City Council held hearings this week on a resolution addressing the crisis at WBAI-FM, the New York station of Pacifica Radio, the nation's oldest and largest progressive radio network. The committee heard testimony about the censorship, firings, and bannings of staff at WBAI, as well as statements from Pacifica arguing that by looking into the affairs of the station, the city council was improperly interfering in its internal affairs. Kevin Pritchard reports from the New York Independent Media Center.
This is indeed an official hearing of the committee of the council. Resolution 1723 supports the democratic legal management at WBAI 99.5 FM radio.
On Monday, May 7, 2001, the committee of the City Council of New York held a public hearing on Resolution 1723. Fired and banned morning show host Bernard White spoke about the Christmas coup at WBAI.
Well, it's been about 4 months since the WBAI Christmas coup was the small band of disgruntled staff led by Utrice Lead, under the auspices of Bessie Wash, Pacifica's executive director, took over WBAI. The fact is that this was an illegal act in contravention to WBAI's bylaws. When the takeover took place, we were experiencing an unprecedented success as a listener-sponsored radio station.
Leslie Kagan, member of the National Board of the Pacifica Foundation, spoke about Pacifica and WBAI's place in the media landscape of the United States.
For more than 40 years, WBAI has been one of the five stations around the country that make up Pacifica. Pacifica is a unique institution. There is no other free speech, community-based, corporate-free network in this nation. As the nationwide control of the mass media is concentrated in fewer hands, The danger of losing this precious resource grows daily.
A spokesperson for Pacifica Foundation Executive Director Bessie Wash accused the City Council of creating an illegal resolution.
The concerned friends of WBAI have accused the Pacifica Foundation of intervening in the affairs of WBAI and have asked the Council of the City of New York to adopt a resolution that endorses a series of demands made by the concerned friends. Adoption of the proposed resolution would not be only unwise but contrary to law.
For the record, I'd just like to indicate that the City Council has the authority to pass a resolution such as this. The Council has the authority to comment on labor disputes, comment on disputes which affect the property and the people and affairs of the City of New York.
Eutrice Lead, installed as interim general manager at WBAI in late December when she changed the station locks in the middle of the night in what some have called the Christmas coup, did not appear, but instead she presented, through an assistant, a document entitled Committee for the Preservation of Integrity and Independence at WBAI. In the document, she alleges that the City Council had never attempted to contact WBAI or Pacifica Management to discuss Resolution 1723.
At no time was the management of WBAI or the governing board of Pacifica Foundation consulted by the sponsors to ascertain the facts regarding WBAI's decision to effect certain internal administrative adjustments and personal modifications.
Councilmember Christine Quinn, primary sponsor of the resolution, responds to Eutrice Leeds' allegations.
I'm the prime sponsor of the resolution, so I think I'm the person that you referenced when you said that the sponsor gave no notification, sought no information, or something to that effect?
I'm just here to read the message. I'm not here to quibble with you about
it. Okay. And you're reading the message on whose behalf?
Ms. Eutrice Lead.
Okay. Well, then, I just want to state for the record, so you could then carry this message back. I have, and many of my colleagues have, sent numerous letters to the station requesting the facts, requesting answers to questions, and most recently requesting a meeting. That second letter requesting a meeting was never responded to.
Councilmember Cruz inquired about the status of WBAI's FCC radio license.
I'm going to ask a question. Is WBAI up for sale?
No, it was last Friday. The chairman of Pacifica was on, Mr. Acosta and Ms. Marshawn, and they stated emphatically that they were not going to sell the station like three or four times, okay? And they also plan on opening three new stations in the Midwest.
For Free Speech Radio News, this has been Kevin Pritchard of the Independent Media Center of New York City.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. Over 40 reporters on four continents and in 14 states are on strike against Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. These reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line. They need your support. For more information, go to the strike's website at www.savepacifica.net/strike or call 510-287-5551. That's 510-287-5551. This newscast was produced by Aaron Glantz. Jade Padgett-Seekins is the technical producer. Thanks to Vanessa Tate for technical assistance. I'm Matt Martin. Please tune in again next week.